and the beer goes in us. He then lifted the other containers. These go into transmission. Got it, John? Mind if I use that shirt to wipe off the dipstick, dipstick? John looked very pleased with his comeback.
Took you nearly 100 miles to think of that one, didn't it?
Gene offered, never one to allow himself to be topped. Because of our delay, I was glad that we'd allowed enough time to make it to Groom Lake before night fell. The tests were generally conducted shortly after the sun went down. As we bounced along Groom Lake Road, a washboard dirt road at the far end of the site and outside the installation's boundaries, I had to laugh when John turned off the headlights.
This is exactly the right vehicle for a stealth operation, isn't it?
John nodded.
35 feet of bone and machinery rattling stealth at your service, guaranteed to alert anyone of your presence within a mile and a half.
Let's just hope we don't have to make a fast getaway, Gene added.
I wasn't sure if he was truly concerned, but I reminded him, and more especially Tracy, we're on a public road on public land. No one can tell us that we can't be here. Besides, with John with us, all we have to do is drop his name and his mom's, and all will be forgiven. Tracy looked at me, and I watched a shadow of worry pass across her face before she smiled and squeezed my hand. Along with some food and beverages, we'd also unpacked John's Celestron telescope, a couple of pairs of binoculars, and a video camera and tripod. We went about the business of setting up the devices. Once the equipment was set up, we stood, shifting nervously from foot to foot, and waited. We didn't have to wait very long. Within minutes after settling in, John, who was looking through the telescope, shouted, "I got something!" He pointed into the night sky to our north and east toward Area 51 and S4. A light had suddenly appeared above the Papoose Mountains. A bright light, at the orange end of the spectrum, began to glow brightly. I stood focusing my attention on the bright object as it appeared approximately 45 degrees above the horizon. A few instants later, it appeared at 60 degrees above the horizon. Then, seemingly in the time it took for me to blink again, it had climbed again and was then 30 degrees to the right of where I had just been focusing. I heard a commotion behind and a few muttered swear words and exclamations of surprise and delight. I kept my eyes on the lights. Once again, the light moved in what I could only describe as a staircase maneuver, appearing at one height and the up, over, up, and over.
"That's no winged aircraft," John said, his voice firm with conviction.
I recognized his authoritative tone mixed with a bit of awe.
"No way in hell anything we produce could make those kinds of maneuvers. Flat out impossible."
"Did you see that?" Gene said, nearly shouting. "Sipping along like that and then just stopping? How in the heck can it do that?"
After I'd seen the low-performance flight, I was certain that the gravity control theory we'd arrived at was correct. Seeing this high-performance flight only confirmed it. It's nearly impossible to convey in words how quickly the light moved from one location to another. I'd seen jets flying overhead in the night sky, and I could easily scan their path of travel with my eyes while my head remained still. Not so with this. Even from that great a distance from the light source, at times the craft's maneuvers had the light moving out of our fixed line of sight. It was astounding and thrilling to see how that reactor and its other components actually worked in a real-time application. I had an even greater admiration for the engineering behind the emitters. How could they move so quickly to accommodate the kind of movements the craft was making? How could objects as large as they were, and made from a material that was somewhere between a metal and a ceramic, move so quickly to allow them to point in the direction that the craft was moving in? They appeared to be rigid structures, yet they moved with the fluidity and flexibility of a muscle. Were they, when under power, somehow transformed into a more supple, more elastic material? I also wondered about the color of the discharge surrounding the craft. Why did it appear to be orange? Not pumpkin orange, but duller, with more brown mixed in. When I'd seen the low-performance test, the corona discharge had been a bluish purple. Now, with the thing in flight, and presumably expending more energy, it was producing a discharge at the longer end of the wavelength spectrum. Orange wasn't in the spectra of atomic hydrogen that would produce bright reds like in the aurora. If oxygen molecules were excited, you'd see purples or blues from nitrogen being ionized. Just another piece of the puzzle. I thought of sodium vapor lights, the kind that cast an orange glow and are frequently used to light city streets. Was it possible that the craft was some sort of sodium alloy? Sodium is very light. It floats on water, and the parts we'd been working with were incredibly light. But sodium is also terribly reactive with moisture. Perhaps it overcame that characteristic somehow. Maybe this was a big anode, a positively charged electrode by which electrons leave a device. I wished that I had brought the compact spectrograph I owned. It would have shown the Fraunhofer lines in the light, and therefore identify which elements were present. Because we weren't in line of the direction the emitters were pointing, we couldn't see what form the distortion was taking, how it might have affected our visual sense of the area around the emitters specifically, and the craft generally. If we had been standing right beneath it, right there at S4, we would have been able to see that, and I could compare it to what I'd witnessed during the low-performance test. Eventually, the light descended below the peaks, and the test was over. We all stood silently for a minute. The sky filled with stars, and the night air felt chilled again. Crickets chirped, and the wind rustled a creosote bush, and I smelled its fragrance. The whole time the test flight had been going on, I'd been aware of very little going on around me, all of my other sensory apparatus shifting power to my eyes. I heard a voice, as if I was coming up from being submerged in water. I gradually made a sense of those sounds. "Here we are, at a super-secret government installation in the desert outside of Las Vegas near Groom Lake. What we've witnessed rising over the Papoose Mountains confirms what many have long suspected and the government has long denied." The voice was John's. He stood in front of the video camera that he'd mounted on the tripod, and he was sounding very much like a news reporter doing one of those live-from-scene broadcasts. The camera's light cast him in a bluish glow, and just outside that light, I could see Gene standing, still scanning the sky, his eyes ablaze and his smile a wide gash across his face. "Amazing," Gene said. "Amazing." He lightly tapped the side of his temple with the flat of his hand and kept his head wobbling for a few seconds. John was still narrating his story, and Gene came up to me with his hand out.
"Thank you. Thanks for this, Bob. I can't tell you what this means to me, that you shared this."
I was glad to have done it and told Gene just that. Then he went on.
"I know that maybe John won't say this. You know how we can sometimes be. I think I know why you invited him, too. Guy spent a lot of time believing in this stuff, catching hell for it sometimes. You let him see what he's believed in and wanted to see. That's a nice thing you did."
I had considered John's situation before, but Gene made me understand things on a deeper level. I could empathize with John. I knew some things, and if events hadn't unfolded like they had, I might not have ever been able to share what I knew with anyone else. Little did I know just how far the parallels between John's plight and mine would extend. I joined John and Gene in loading up the gear. Tracy was still standing in place, arms wrapped around herself, staring up at the sky.
"You think it helped?" Gene asked me.
"What do you mean?" He nodded toward Tracy.
"Had to be a little weird for the two of you, leaving the house on short notice all the time, things like that. Seeing is believing."
Maybe on some subconscious level, I had wanted to prove to Tracy that my absences from home were for the reasons I'd told her. This might have made me a bad husband, but at the time, I really didn't have much of a sense that my work at S4 had put much of a strain on our relationship. I believed she understood what was necessary and believed her when she told me that she trusted me. Still, it seemed odd to me then, and remains so until today, that Tracy hadn't said a whole lot while watching the demonstration or after. She'd expressed some concern when I first told her of the plan and what it might mean for me and for us if I violated the security agreements I'd entered into. At least, after the high-performance test, she could better appreciate what was at risk. We had a long drive ahead of us, and we all were early risers, so we quickly got back into the RV for the drive home. I think that we'd all gotten a jolt of adrenaline through our systems, and were paying the price for it afterwards with lethargy. A few days later, I let Jean know that I was planning to go out to the site again. This time, I had invited another friend along. John couldn't make it. I was a little more concerned that time about being watched and tailed, so Jean and I worked out a plan to use a rental car to drive out there. We debated about meeting points and drop-off locations, working ourselves up into a bit of a state for what proved to be no good reason. Still, better to be safe than sorry. There was a kind of Three Stooges quality to our planning, as if we mixed up the two CIAs, the Culinary Institute of America and the Central Intelligence Agency. Tracy was going to join us again, and maybe it was the overlay of fear that clung to her that had Jean and me in a bit of a tizzy. Some of that was due to the one discussion that the participants in the first trip did have on the way home. My reluctance to write about it is a reflection of what they discussed and my long-standing lack of any real focus on this issue. Jean had remarked that the entire time the flight was going on, I seemed lost in my own little world. That was true. I was fascinated to see the craft in flight, and was trying to visualize how the systems I saw were capable of producing that kind of performance. John reminded me of a remark that he had made at the time, while the craft was still in the air, and that I didn't even remember him making. "You were still just standing there with your tunnel vision goggles on, and I said, at minimum, that thing's got to be going 700 miles an hour. Then it's stopping on a dime. Then it's back up to 700 miles an hour again. Can you imagine what that kind of lateral acceleration and deceleration would do to the being inside it?" "You're right. I don't remember you saying that." "And you're right. Essentially, that would be the equivalent of hitting a wall at 700 miles an hour. I don't know for sure if the human exoskeleton could sustain that kind of velocity, of having the organs sloshing around. I don't know if they'd come out, but they'd certainly be crushed." John raised his finger in the air. "Precisely what I was trying to get you to conclude. A human body couldn't survive that speed. I'm not talking about the human body keeping its guts intact. I'm talking about there not being a human body in there at all. Some other being had to be piloting that thing, no doubt." Jean said, "I don't know about that for sure, but it did get me thinking. I know that you said, Bob, that there were 9 other of that kind of craft out in the hangar. I was just sitting here wondering what those beings' lives were like. Did some of them work at the factory or whatever that produced them? Did they go home to mate at the end of the day and be joined by their kids who went to school?" I considered that for a minute. "I have to confess to you guys, to me, that's the least interesting part of this. I didn't consider any of that at all while watching the test. The machine was the thing for me from the beginning, and it still is. I don't know if I believe what I read in those briefings. I admit, I didn't read them all. But still, what fascinates me the most is the technology. The rest..." I let the words drift along the highway to scatter with the wind. In the days after witnessing that first high-performance flight test, I'd been taken up with other ideas than the life of the beings that created those craft and how the craft arrived here. In some ways, that was immaterial. As I've said many times, the allure for me was the immensity of the power that propulsion system produced. What stymied me was the realization that it produced that power in a nearly reactionless fashion. As near as we could determine, apparently no nuclear reaction was going on.
we could detect no change in the identity or characteristics of an atomic nucleus that resulted from it being bombarded with an energetic particle. And there were no fission or fusion products left over from a reaction. As near as we could determine, no chemical reaction was taking place. We detected no rearrangement of the molecular or ionic structure of a substance that produced a new one with a different chemical identity. No combustion. No decomposition. No synthesis. We determined that the propulsion system bent light and distorted gravity. But that meant that we were dealing with rougher concepts than the kinds of reactions I just mentioned. Most people could understand decomposition. They'd either seen it or smelled it. But when you were talking about the disruption of gravity, you couldn't visualize or smell a rotting piece of meat. Instead, you had to play around with more abstract concepts like time and distance. For most of us, those are firm parts of our reality. I look at a clock and see what time it is. I don't think about how that clock is, in a sense, an artificial construct. We as humans created the concept of time as existing in blocks of 24 hours. It's a good construct, but it is still artificial. The same with space and distance. I drove 12 miles to get from my house to my job. But how we broke up that distance into miles is completely arbitrary. That's why there's a metric system and an English system that give you different totals. Same distance, but different numbers entirely. We've all agreed to use these systems of measurements, but in trying to explain how this craft moved, how it bent gravity, you'd also have to understand that our usual, everyday conceptions of time and space and distance weren't going to serve us very well. John and Jean had joked about the need for greater minds to solve the question of where is the middle of nowhere. The same was true of coming up with an explanation that really and truly and accurately described how those craft, and that one craft in particular, moved from one location to the next. While I spent the next week working, I anticipated that my fellow spies were going to look to me to help them grasp an explanation for what they saw. For the 29th of March, 1989, the mean temperature was 70 degrees, with a low of 57 and a high of 80. Those facts were noted and recorded. We set out to note and record what we believed would be evidence of the craft's capabilities and existence. Tracy and I took separate cars, Jean picked up the rental car, and we all met at the rendezvous point. Jean and I took more circuitous routes than necessary. Our fourth, a man I'll refer to as Jason, met us along the way just off of Interstate 15. We proceeded as before and set up our viewing area. As happened the first time, the light from the craft glowed in the distance, did its staircase maneuver, and then others. I heard Jean ask, "Did you see that move it just did? It went vroom, boom." "No, I didn't," I said. I had just set up the video camera, capturing Jean's words and my response. A few seconds later, Jean said, "Look at how light it's getting." Jason had joined me at the camera, and I was still working on the focus. We exchanged a few words about whether or not we were getting anything on the view screen. Finally, satisfied that the camera was capturing the increasingly bright light, I stepped away and watched with a naked eye. The craft hovered for a bit. I blinked, and it had moved closer, the light increasing in intensity. The pattern repeated itself.
"I think it's coming at us," Jean said.
"It is, isn't it?" Jason said. "That's pretty cool." By the time they were finished saying those things, the light had grown much larger and much, much closer. We all scrambled behind the trunk of the car, crouching and looking skyward. Jean looked at me, startled.
"What are you doing? You're never scared. You sit at home making nitro like it's pesto."
I had to think about it for a second. I wasn't really frightened. I told him, "I'm a human being. Instincts kick in. Bright glowing object in the sky moving my way fast, I go for cover."
"That's reassuring," Jean said.
I wasn't sure if he meant that I was human and had natural reactions, or something else. I didn't think any more about it. "As the power output increases, the intensity of the light increases," I told them all. The light wasn't eye-searing, but it was somewhat painful to look at. We were able to speak in a normal conversational volume since the craft produced no discernible sound. It was still well above our position.
"It was like I couldn't see it move," Jason said. "One second it was there, the next second it was over there. Almost like a strobe effect or something."
"Looks like it'd be a fun ride," Gene said. "Just be sure to keep your sphincter closed tight."
"Only you would say that, Gene," I told him.
And then, cutting him off before he could ask, "No, I don't know if they have sphincters."
"Well, all I can say," Jason added as he laughed, "mine is quivering right now."
"You weren't completely off track about the strobe effect. As the propulsion system produces more power, that glow is brighter. The gravitational effect also disturbs light, time, and space," I told Jason.
"Breathtaking," he said. "Stunning. My face feels frozen from having been smiling for so long."
By this time, the lights had darted back over the mountain, still above them, before the sky above S4 went dark.
"Worth the drive out of here?" Gene asked Jason.
"Hell yes," he said.
"I've seen it twice now, and this time was even better with the kind of flyover, or at least fly-at-us view that we got."
Gene paused.
"I don't know, Bob. Is it right to use the word fly? I mean, people call them flying saucers, but how that thing moves doesn't really compare."
"I guess that fly is the right word if you think about something being above the ground and moving."
"How can it possibly do what it did?" Jason asked.
We all stood in a tight semicircle, collapsing tripods and folding chairs. I'd been thinking about this moment for a while, how I might be able to provide a visual for everyone to understand as best I could, or at least provide a visual for the concept. I took a $5 bill out of my wallet and held it up for everyone like a magician about to do a trick. So imagine that this bill is the universe. If I take a pen and put a mark here at the far edge of the bill, that represents a starting point. When we traditionally think of time and space and travel, that dot would move incrementally across the bill from one edge to the other, or in some other path. For the sake of argument, let's just say it is going to move directly across in a straight line. To do that, to make you be able to see that, I'd have to take my pen and, in essence, make a whole series of dots from one edge to the other. In other words, I'd draw a line across the bill. That's how we experience movement as a series of moves, one after the other, across a surface.
"Got it," someone said.
"Well, with this craft's propulsion system capable of gravitational change, it's like it folds the bill in a series of moves, bringing that far corner, where my line eventually ended, closer and closer to it until it was across the span of distance. Only it did it far faster than you or I could make the moves to fold that bill."
"I see. That makes sense," Gene said.
Jason nodded. Tracy nodded as well. "The thing is, we can all understand that on a certain level, I mean, that's a rudimentary explanation of it. Astrophysicists and others might have more technical and more elegant, even, ways to explain what I just did. But the most important thing about all of this is that here on Earth, we can conceptualize this, but we can't, or at least to this point, haven't been able to produce a machine capable of doing what that craft does. We simply haven't. Not by a long shot. And that's what I was being asked to help do."
"And what if we could do what that thing did?" Gene asked.
"We'd be masters of the universe. I hope that we'd use it for good, but we could create unbelievably powerful weapons of mass destruction as well. We could become destroyers of worlds. It boggles my mind to think of what it would mean to be able to generate that kind of power over gravity."
"Anti-gravity?"
Jason asked. I suppose you could call it that, but what's the opposite of gravity? What does that mean? I see your point, he said, and then added, stating the thought for me, at some point, language just kind of falls short of all this, doesn't it?
Speaking of falling, Gene said, I'm about to collapse. Let's get home.
As was true after the first test flight we all saw, we didn't speak much about what we'd seen on the drive home or in the days after. Part of that was because of the secretive nature of our visits, but mostly it was due to the simple fact that we all had lives and jobs and families to go back to. It was kind of funny to think of it in terms of the capabilities that craft had over space and time, but the world didn't stop turning because of what we'd witnessed. We just had to keep on moving forward. To that end, I tried again to contact Dennis and never got through, never got a return call to my messages. Strange to think that I was part of what seemed to be some unraveling of one of the great mysteries of the world, but I couldn't get a guy to return a simple phone call. I suppose that's what I deserved for choosing to do government work. No force of nature, terrestrial or extraterrestrial, could compete with that kind of stubbornness. Chapter 8. Some say that the third time's the charm. In this case, that was true, but in our case, the charm was used to break the spell that had me enthralled to the work I'd been doing at Area 51's S4 site. In the intervening weeks since I'd been last called in to observe the test flights, I'd added to my list of frustrations the nature of how the work I was doing there was being conducted. It had troubled me from the beginning. In science, you should be able to take a linear approach to problem-solving. You set up an experiment or your thinking with a clear beginning, middle, and end. You do as much reading as you can, familiarize yourself with the work that others have done, etc. We all learned about the scientific method in school, and it's a good model that has stood the test of time. But at S4, and working for whomever it was that I was really working for in the military and government, I'd been placed in a situation where the linear was out the window, where the scientific method didn't consist of a series of defined steps, but was more scattershot. In a way, our approach to the problem of reverse engineering the propulsion system was like what a diagram of that high-performance test flight and the craft's appearance would have looked like. First here, then there, then up, then down. I'd really had it with every aspect of the job, if I could properly refer to it as a job. And wouldn't you know it, just when I'd reached that point, they'd reached out to me and called me again to let me know that I should report the next day to work again at S4. I'd been so used to the regularity of the woman on the phone's patter, the it is now X time and you need to report at Y time, and that Y time being just an hour or two from X time, that the next day really threw me for a loop. Maybe it was an act of passive aggressiveness on my part, but I simply said, thanks, and hung up the phone with no intent whatsoever of going in as instructed. No one had bothered to respond to my messages, not even to say, we can't tell you anything now, but we will be in touch when we have more information for you. Instead, they answered with silence. I was going to respond similarly, but with absence. I also wondered why the next day. Had they observed us somehow? The car outside the house and the following was irregular at that point, but then again, maybe they'd changed up their tactics. Who knew? If they had followed us, I thought, so what? We were on public land, violating no laws. Of course, I was violating all of the agreements I'd signed, but desperate times call for desperate measures. On April 2nd, another Wednesday, and the day of the call to report back, Gene, Tracy, Jason, and Tracy's sister Kristen joined me on another trip up to Groom Lake. You might think that the novelty had worn off by then, but it hadn't. When the craft flew towards us that second time, and we'd all ducked behind the car, a new dimension had been added. Who knew what other elements to the high-performance test might be added? What additional information could I glean from witnessing the craft in operation? At that point, obviously, I didn't care about how that knowledge might help me help them, but I wanted to know for myself the answer to the question of how the systems functioned. We took more precautions on the trip out there. We made frequent stops and diverted from the highway a couple of times and looped around the interchange to see if anyone was following. That bit of trickery added to the excitement. We talked about a number of things, the subject getting serious only once when Gene mentioned that the oil spill near Valdez, Alaska was spreading, and residents there on the Gulf of Alaska were up in arms. For my part, I was more interested in an item that appeared revealing that scientists at Brigham Young University had fused heavy forms of hydrogen into helium at room temperature. They hoped that the process, piezoelectric fusion, in which a heavy form of hydrogen is electrically infused into titanium or palladium, might lead to a viable power source someday. They believed that they were still a long way off from it being a viable source of energy, but given what had happened with the oil spill, more and more concerns about greenhouse gases being expressed, I was at least hopeful. Obviously, I also thought of it in terms of the propulsion system I'd been working on, how it gave off no real heat during its reactionless operation. I saw Tracy roll her eyes a bit as she looked at her sister. They both nodded and said, "Okay, Dad." I laughed, grateful that their scientist father had instilled in them a tolerance for that kind of talk. Eventually, the sisters' conversation turned to who might want to join them to see the Tom Hanks film, The Burbs. I knew that they were teasing us, but the point was clear. Lighten up. They were both highly intelligent women, but this was an outing, an adventure, and not part of a seminar. To avoid detection and vary our pattern, we drove down an even more isolated road off of Groom Lake, deeper into the desert, on a track that the ranchers used to ferry their cattle. We were careful to still be on a public road and still have a good vantage point from which to view the test flight. Our growing anticipation had us all nearly giddy. We joked around with one another, and it was good to leave behind the burden of my decision to end my relationship with Dennis and the rest of the people who had anything to do with S4. We returned to the theme of our ill-preparedness to be spies and to carry out our approach in a manner that even approached stealth.
"And you were the one who gave John so much crap the first time about not having enough transmission fluid?" I said to Gene.
"Yeah, but he's a pilot," he said again defensively, knowing what was coming next.
"But to not have enough gas in the car to even get us onto the interstate?" Jason added, referring to part of our plan to stop shortly after meeting up to see if we were being tailed.
"All part of the plan. That quick pit stop was designed to suss out the situation."
"What's a suss?"
"Don't you mean assess?"
"Or maybe that you're an ass," Jason said, eliciting an appreciative laugh from the rest of us for his wordplay. By this time, we had rolled to a stop and were setting up our viewing area.
Suddenly, we heard a soft thud and then saw a greenish round light rolling in front of us. A moment later, we all stood there with a deer-in-the-headlights look on our faces as a car parked no more than 20 feet from our position switched on its high beams. I was at the rear of our formation, mostly hidden. I ducked down, knowing that of all of us gathered there, I was the one who was in the most vulnerable position if we were to be detained.
"What are you folks doing out here?" I heard someone say. "Who's asking?" Gene said.
"Installation security," a different voice replied. "You are on military property. I'm going to have to ask you to leave. If you don't comply, there's Nevada State Troopers in the area that I'll radio."
At that point, I decided it was best for me to get out of there. I'd asked Gene a while ago to keep my gun in his car. I eased the door open. We'd switched off the dome light ahead of time to avoid detection, and eased the gun out of the glove box. Using the cover of everyone else's voices telling the security personnel that we were on public roads and not violating any statutes,
I hid out in the bush away from the car. After a brief protest, our group said that they would do as asked and leave. I watched as the security detail, the two men, got back in their car and waited. Gene got everyone in his car, and within a few seconds, they took off slowly in the opposite direction of the security vehicle. I waited for a bit until the security car began to move away. Once their taillights began to dim, I scrambled along in the underbrush and soon caught up with Gene and the rest of them and got inside the vehicle. We all bemoaned our fate and grumbled about not being able to see the test flight, but we also all tacitly understood the precarious position I was in and, to a lesser extent, the jeopardy I'd placed them in. We were still rolling along slowly. We crested an incline, and Gene muttered, "Oh, shit!" Ahead of us, a pair of headlights stared at us. A few seconds later, its police lights flashed.
"This might be funny, except it isn't," Jason said. "Like being back in high school and being hassled for trying to find a place to drink."
A uniformed officer stood in the middle of the road with a flashlight in one hand. As we neared him, he raised the other palm up. We stopped.
"Where are you going?" he asked.
I knew something was up when he didn't ask to see license and registration immediately.
"Just saw some lights in the sky from the interstate and came out here to get a better look," Gene said. "We understood this to be public property. No signs for trespassing or anything like that."
The officer trained the flashlight all around the inside of the car.
"Shut off your ignition. Stay right here."
We did as instructed, speculating about what the cop was going to do. We saw him speaking into his radio's microphone. After a brief conversation, he returned to the driver's side of Gene's car.
"There's five of you in this vehicle."
"Yes, that's right."
"I got a report from the security guys that they saw four people in a vehicle matching this description. You got an explanation for that?"
Jason spoke up from the back seat.
"Well, it's dark. Those guys were just security men, you know. They came up on us, and one of them dropped their night vision light. Not exactly the most competent guys in the world."
All of us in the car laughed at that insinuation. The police officer didn't.
"I'm sure they can count. Four when they stopped you, five now. I'd like to see some identification from all of you. All five of you, please."
Each of us handed our driver's license to Gene, who collected them and handed them over. The policeman looked at each one. Then he rifled through the deck, then walked around the car and used the flashlight to illuminate our faces to make sure that our faces matched the photos. I had gotten into the driver's side seat and returned the gun to the glove box. I wasn't concerned about having it. I'd registered it and was legally allowed to transport it in a vehicle. I was concerned about what we had in the trunk. It was nothing illegal. John's telescope, the spectroscope I'd finally remembered to bring along, a Geiger counter, and a few other scientific instruments. Any one of those items would destroy our story about just happening by and seeing lights. Of course, the police officer asked if he could search the car. This was just after he asked us all to exit the vehicle. We complied with that request, but not with the search.
"Well," he said, "I have to tell you, this doesn't look good for you, and won't if you have to appear in court. What that tells me is that you've got something to hide."
Kristen spoke up.
"Officer, you said that this was a voluntary search. Our not granting you that access isn't evidence of probable cause. I'm fairly conversant with the statutes that apply here, so unless you can explain to us why it is that you've decided that this is no longer a case of us..."
The officer held up his hand.
"Then I'm going to my car, and I'm going to call a wrecker and have you towed out of here."
Kristen took a few steps forward.
"No, you're not calling a wrecker. You can detain us for up to an hour, but that's it. You are not searching the car, and you are not getting us towed. You have no probable cause. If you insist on doing what you say you're going to do, then you're going to have a lot of explaining to do to a judge, to your superiors, and I don't think you're going to like what they have to say."
The officer walked away. Tracy smiled animatedly, the first real genuine expression of pleasure I'd seen in a while.
Way to go, sis. Those law classes of yours are paying off.
I may never become a paralegal, but at least I can sound like I know what I'm talking about when dealing with these guys. I can't believe he thought he'd scare us into letting him search us like that.
Thanks, Kristen, I said.
We could have stood there all night just saying no to him, I said. In an odd way, being out in the desert, watching the police car's Mars lights illuminate the landscape, felt so much stranger to me than if we'd all been watching an alien spacecraft flying around. I'd been bored and unsatisfied with working as a photo processor. Life certainly wasn't boring anymore, but I wondered then if it was worth all this stress. There had to be some middle ground. I remembered my mother using the term happy medium when I was a kid and telling her that maybe an unhappy large was more what I was going to be on the lookout for in my life. Seeing the faces of everyone gathered around me heartened me. None of them were pointing fingers at me and blaming me for possibly getting them into trouble or for wasting their time. They knew what I'd put at risk in sharing the information I had with them. They were all doing their best to protect me. Despite the obvious potential complications, it felt good to be there with a group who were all working together. After about 5 minutes spent in his cruiser, the police officer approached us. Checking to be sure he was returning the right licenses to the right individuals, he handed back everyone's identification but mine. He held on to the last one, looked at me, and then said with a tone that I had difficulty deciphering, something between sarcasm and admiration, "I guess they know who you are down there." He nodded toward the base. He handed me my license, stepped back, and said, "You're all free to go. Drive safe and have a good night." We all breathed a sigh of relief and got back into the car. On the ride back, we didn't talk much at all. Jean asked the question that was on my mind, and I assumed on everyone else's.
"What's next?"
"We'll see," I said. "I'm beyond trying to figure out what's going to happen next." For a few minutes, we tried to come up with a plausible explanation for our presence out there. It soon became clear that it was pointless to even try. It was so obvious what was going on that it was a waste of time and mental energy to go through an excuse-making exercise. A lot of thoughts passed through my mind as we headed toward Las Vegas, but I never considered that one of the group I trusted had broken that unspoken bond and said something that might have drawn the security guard's attention to that area. I was sure of that and little else. I remembered a conversation I had with Dennis after learning about the scientists and engineers who'd been killed while working with the reactor. I would have thought that an incident of that type would make the news. When I asked Dennis why it hadn't, he simply said, "We took care of that." I had understood before that these men had control over every bit of information. If something was going to happen to me, no one would ever know the truth of how I came to lose my life. Oddly, that didn't trouble my sleep that night, and I woke up feeling more rested than I had in a while. By sunset the next day, I knew what was next. I answered the phone, and Dennis Mariani was on the line.
"I'll be at your home in 25 minutes. We need to meet."
I knew it was useless to make any kind of excuse, so I said, "I'll be here." When I answered the door to find Dennis standing on the porch, I was surprised to see that there was no vehicle other than my car in the driveway.
"You're going to be driving," he said while looking at his watch. "Let's go."
After I got through buckling in, I asked him, "Where to?"
"Indian Springs."
Though he didn't elaborate, I understood that he meant Indian Springs Air Force Base. It was located just north of Las Vegas. I had thought it was deactivated, and that troubled me for a few beats. Why was I going to an abandoned military base alone and at night? It all seemed too sinister. Then I remembered seeing some craft taking off from there every now and then. Maybe there'd be a full staff on site, people who would be able to account for my presence there. We drove along in silence, the tension thick. I was trying to stay calm and not let on that I was thinking too much about what was going on, not let him see that I was on edge. Didn't they once use Indian Springs back in the day to aid nuclear testing? I thought I read something about sniffer planes being launched from there. Dennis grunted an indistinct response. For the remainder of the hour drive, neither of us spoke. I squirmed in my seat, glancing nervously into the rearview mirror, dreading what was to come. As we all had at the start of the drive back home after being detained by the police, I frantically tried to come up with a reason why I'd been out there with my friends and family. Eventually, I gave up. By the time I saw the first signs for the base, I was resigned to doing this. All I could do was fall back on the truth. Once we were through the gates and then into an office, Dennis was joined by two other men, both armed. They looked like they were part of the security team out at S4. Dennis made it apparent that he was really pissed off. He sat down in a chair and pulled it close to mine. With his face inches from mine, he said, "When we told you this was a highly classified project, how did that get twisted in your mind to think that you could tell your friends about it?" Something about the way he phrased it and the absurdity of the premise made me smile and chuckle a little bit. I truly thought at first that Dennis was injecting a note of levity into the situation. I was wrong. The man seated next to me reached for his weapon and said, "That's probably not funny." Dennis continued. Though he didn't raise his voice much, his accusatory tone was sharp, and he seemed as if he was biting off each of the sounds he made. I sat there eyeing a black box on the table in front of me. Was it a microphone, part of some intercom system, or a recording device? "Do you not understand the nature of the agreements you signed? Are you not aware of the consequences of violating those agreements?" After a few minutes of simply sitting there and essentially being pummeled by the comments and questions, I was asked the most obvious questions, the first one that seemed to be one Dennis wanted me to answer. What was I doing out there, and why was I there with those people? "I wasn't sure what you guys were going to do with me, once you stopped calling me in to work in the lab." Even before I could finish that second statement, I sensed that this was the wrong tack to take. Each of the men displayed body language that this was not the avenue to go down. Arms folded across a chest, a lean back in the chair, a lean forward, and a slow, nearly imperceptible shake of the head, an eyebrow quivering and then lifting. Thinking quickly on the go, I then smiled and said, "Look, everybody knows that something to do with experimental aircraft and testing goes on out there. If you live in Vegas, you know that. So, when they heard I had a job out there, they assumed. All we did was go out there and watch the lights in the sky. I figured that would answer any of the questions they had, alleviate their curiosity, do a little disinformation. No big deal. No breach of security. I didn't tell them anything." Once I got started talking, a kind of mental momentum took over. By the time I was halfway into it, I'd almost convinced myself that what I was saying was true. At the same time, I wondered about my assumption that these guys were part of the security group. Would they have been allowed to hear what Dennis was talking about with me? "Don't you understand that this project is far more important than any one single person?" Dennis asked. "More important than your life. More important than mine." Like I said, they knew that things were going on with aircraft. Then, uncertain of the other two men, and careful not to say anything about the alien nature of the propulsion system and craft, I added, "These were lay people, the general public. They wouldn't have been able to figure out anything but what I told them, and I told them nothing." "Nothing?" Dennis jumped on that word immediately. "Essentially nothing. Just that there were flights."
"What do you mean, essentially nothing?"
the guy to my left said. "If you let me finish..."
"I think you're finished."
Dennis intervened.
And just what is it that you think we're going to do with you and your friends?
Nothing with them. I figured I would go back to work on the project.
You smiling again? You think this is funny? Don't you understand how serious this is?
The interrupter was at it again. Dennis sat back, as if to get a better view of the show. I wasn't aware that I had been smiling. Maybe under the stress of the situation, I had. I knew that I had to fight the urge to say that I understood the gravity of the situation.
This isn't funny. This is no joke.
The interrupter went on.
Well, maybe Mr. Lazar doesn't understand what the rules are around here.
They didn't see anything. A few lights in the sky. Oh, what a big deal. A few lights in the sky. The interrupter must not have liked my tone. He nudged the gun against me, and I lost my composure for a bit.
This is ridiculous. It's not like I told them that what they were seeing was aliens flying around in their saucers. This is...
I stopped myself. Dennis looked like I had kicked him in the balls. He recovered quickly and said to the interrupter,
"Please leave the room."
Once the man left, Dennis switched off the device on the desk. He tore a sheet off the legal pad that had been sitting there. Presumably the whole time, though it hadn't registered with me until then, I was so shaken.
"Write down their names and their contact information."
I hated the idea of having to do that. It was one thing for the police to have gotten it from their driver's licenses, but this was far more Judas-like an action. I felt my throat tighten.
"They have that information already."
"I want you to write it,"
Dennis said, his voice reaching a level of menace that I hadn't heard before. I knew then that this writing had some kind of significance beyond the simple gathering of information. My writing those names and figures down would be an act of betrayal, a demonstration that I was capable of violating any kind of trust.
"I don't know all that information. I don't have people's addresses and phone numbers committed to memory."
Dennis continued to glare at me.
"Look, I'll admit it. I'm scared. I can't think straight right now."
Dennis tapped the sheet of paper.
"Write it. Now."
"I'm telling you,"
I began, my voice sounding even to me like the bleating of a sheep. I stopped and looked at the third who was in the room. The entire time he hadn't spoken, and he had displayed none of the gestures of disapproval or dismay that the others had and that I'd mentally cataloged earlier. He simply stared ahead impassively. Our eyes met, and he continued to regard me as if I was no consequence to him whatsoever. That indicated to me that he was the one I should be most concerned about. He was the one most capable of doing me harm. I was in such a quandary. They would know if I was giving them false information. That would lead them to believe that I had something to hide, that I was capable of other kinds of duplicity, that I had no regard for what they demanded of me, that I was loyal only to myself. If I didn't, I had something to hide, that I'd already committed some acts of duplicity, that I had no regard for what they demanded of me, that I was loyal to someone else. The last was true if I gave them the full information they asked for. Seeing no other way around it, I gave them some information, substituted Gene's office number for his home number, left many things blank, and gave them an empty promise that I would get them what they needed. I could neither be the stand-up guy who openly defied them or the man who was willing to lie down and be run over by their threats. Instead, I sat there in that middle ground, finding nothing to be happy about, and wondering if the man's indifference was somehow a reflection of how I truly felt about myself. Was I too indifferent even to feel self-loathing?
"Next, I want you to tell us who you're working for,"
Dennis said, his lips pursing as he scanned the paper I'd returned to him.
"For you. For whoever you work for. For EG&G. I don't know. Naval Intelligence was on the check, so I guess them."
"You know that's not what I mean. I know that you wanted to sabotage the project. That's clear."
"No," I said, recoiling in my chair. "That's not true at all. Not one bit of it."
This went on for a while, until Dennis looked at his watch.
"We're done here, for now. Go back home. Wait for my call. We'll probably have you come back in."
His last statement was ambiguous. To work, or to be further interrogated? I didn't dare ask. I stood up, and as I did, the interrogator came back in the room. He handed Dennis a stack of papers. Dennis's eyes lit up.
"That's right. That's right. I almost forgot."
He looked at the papers for a few moments.
"Sit down. Sit down."
He waved the papers at me, and they fluttered briefly before coming to rest. "You do know your wife's having an affair," Dennis stated flatly. I sat there not willing to take the bait.
"Been going on for a while. Her flight instructor, a guy named Tony, started back in February. A Valentine's Day thing, I guess."
"Why are you doing this?" I asked. "You could make anything up." "Even these?" he said, holding up the papers.
"These are the transcripts to every call between them.
Funny how nearly all of them took place when you weren't around. Seemed like your schedule was ideal for them to meet up." I tried to tell myself that what I'd said to Dennis was true. They could make anything up. But something deep in my gut told me that wasn't the case. I sat there feeling scooped out, like someone had taken a melon baller and eviscerated me from neck to nuts. When I told Dennis that I didn't want to see the transcripts, my voice sounded tinny, as if it was echoing inside that hollow space inside me. He slid them over anyway. I sat for a few seconds not looking at them. In that brief span, I knew that the empty space inside me was all of the denial I'd kept stored in there leaching away. I'd noticed that Tracy had been distracted and distant. I'd noticed that it seemed like every time I left the house, Tracy did too. At one point early in my time at S4, Jason had come over to the house. We were going to test some new rocket motors for the fireworks display we put on. We left in my car, and I wasn't sure if I had all the motors. Couldn't remember if I'd left a box on a shelf in the garage. Rather than go all the way out into the desert and then discover they weren't there, I pulled over and got out of the car to check what was in the hatch. Everything was there. I climbed back in and checked the wing mirror before I pulled out. There was Tracy's car. She had to have seen me, but she just drove right past. I dismissed it then, but after that, noted but tried not to focus on the dozens of other similar things that happened. Phone calls ending abruptly. Her changing plans at the last minute. I stopped myself from thinking any more about them. I wanted to look, but I didn't. I decided that I didn't need to look through a catalog of my despair and devastation, selecting which item to punish myself with to suit my mood at the time. "Well, thanks, Dennis," I said as I slid the papers back to him.
"No, keep them," he said, sounding more jovial than I'd ever heard him before. "Least we can do."
"Yeah," I said, channeling Gene at that moment. "Your tax dollars at work." To say I walked out of there feeling completely devastated would be an understatement. Tracy's betrayal gutted me. I didn't want to linger on the Indian Springs site, thinking that there were likely to be surveillance cameras. I imagined Dennis sitting there and laughing at me, a deep satisfaction animating his face, if he saw me showing any signs of the anguish I was feeling. I drove away, and on the way home, my sorrow and disillusionment weighed heavily on me. I felt as if I was back in the Puritan days, and someone had attached stones to my body and submersed me in water. I had no energy to struggle against those forces dragging me down. Tracy had once rescued me from the despair that I experienced following my first wife's death, had given me hope that life could be good again. Now that hope had diminished. As the days went on after Dennis's revelation, I became resigned. I truly didn't care whether I lived or died. In addition to feeling betrayed and the sickening thoughts of her having a sexual relationship with another man, and how cliched the whole thing was. With a co-worker, with a man whose contact I'd encouraged and helped pay for, a flight instructor, I came to another gut-wrenching conclusion. One of the reasons why my security clearance was being delayed was due to Tracy's affair. Whoever was administrating the project and was in charge of evaluating my suitability for the security clearance knew this. A man whose wife is cheating on him is likely to find out about her infidelity at some point. He's likely to be emotionally unstable as a result. As a result, he wasn't the best candidate to be entrusted with the kinds of information that I was going to be, and had been, privy to. Not only had Tracy's affair destroyed me emotionally, it had severely damaged my chances of doing what I considered some of the most meaningful work I might ever do. As frustrated as I was with the processes in place at S4, the eventual product of our work could have proved to be life-altering for me and for millions of others. Just because I had sabotaged any chance I had of working there didn't mean that I wouldn't have liked to have continued to do the work. Complicated and conflicted seemed to be the buzzwords for everything I experienced at S4. As I neared our neighborhood, I remembered something else that Dennis had said. Maybe I could reapply in 6 to 9 months. I don't know if he was simply throwing me crumbs or a lifeline. At the time, I envisioned that in the weeks and months to come, I might have to rely on either of those two to help sustain me and keep me moving forward. I came home from the visit with Dennis to an empty house, and in a way, that was fine with me. After everything else that had gone on, I didn't know if I had the energy to confront Tracy immediately with what I'd learned. I knew that I wanted to be on my game, so to speak, but this was anything but a game. I sat in an easy chair in the living room with a drink I'd made, hoping I could be distracted by something mindless on the television. When that didn't work, I prowled around in my home lab. I'd recently bought some electronics equipment I'd had my eye on for a while, and I distractedly read through the manuals while sipping a second drink. Though alcohol should have numbed some of the pain I was feeling, it didn't. It eased my nerves a bit, and after a while what was going on with Dennis receded, but the Tracy betrayal came rushing in. Simply put, I was pissed off. We'd meant a lot to each other, and she'd been there for me during one of the darkest moments in my life. I didn't deserve this. Nothing I'd ever done or said could justify the pain she was inflicting on me. I would never do anything like that to her. If I thought that things weren't right between us, I would have said something, tried to work it out, and if that failed, we would go our separate ways. That would hurt, but nothing compared to this. I must have drifted off. I went upstairs to bed, and Tracy was already there, sound asleep. I got out of bed first the next morning and brewed a pot of coffee. Tracy came down while I was finishing the first cup. She filled her own, and then mine. She sat down and looked at me, widened her eyes in expectation. I didn't say anything. She frowned and said sarcastically, "Good morning." "No, it isn't," I said. "Not by a long shot." "What's going on? What happened?" I told her what I knew and how I'd found out. She sat there looking at me, her expression stealing itself as she fiddled with a spoon. "I don't know what to say," she said after I'd concluded. She shifted in her chair and brought one leg up underneath, turning away from me slightly. "How about, I'm sorry? I'm treating you like shit, and I'm sorry?" "I'm not treating you like shit. Things happen. I wasn't trying to..." I immediately cut her off. "Don't even..." "What?" "Say that you weren't trying to hurt me. How did you expect me to feel? I've been doing nothing but trying to do the best for you, busting my ass to make a life for us, make things as easy as possible for you. Running around at all hours of the night? Leaving me here all the time? What did you expect?" That really got to me. What did I expect? I was nearly shouting at this point. I expected you to understand that I was working on a highly sensitive project. I expected you to understand that the hours were strange. I didn't expect you to start fucking your flight instructor as thanks for me taking on a second job and trying to better things for us. It isn't just the sex. I don't want to hear that. I needed you, especially with everything else going on. Well, if you would have listened to me then, maybe all this Dennis shit wouldn't be hitting the fan. I told you that you were playing with fire, but you love that. You love taking risks and flying in the face of authority. I pounded my hand on the table. The utensil jumped, and a tiny pool of cream shuddered. Don't turn this around on me. I'm not the one who did anything wrong. I'm not turning this around. I'm saying that things are really complicated right now. I heard what you told me about Dennis hauling your ass in. I knew this was going to turn out bad. I knew it. Now's not the time. The hell it isn't. Yeah, we have to talk about marriage. We'll do that. But for now, don't you think we've got a few more pressing items on our agenda to deal with? The phone rang. I locked eyes with Tracy and laughed ruefully. This is how fucked up things are. I'm wondering about the lesser of two evils. Is that your boyfriend calling and wondering where you are, or it's that Dennis luring me out somewhere so he can finish this whole thing off? Tracy and I went around and around for a while, until neither of us was sure who was the monkey and who was the weasel and who was chasing whom. We at last agreed to table for the rest of the day any discussions about next steps, her calling it off, us calling it quits. Let things settle down. Let me focus on what I needed to do. After the reminder she made that I'd put us in jeopardy, that I'd, as she put it, potentially screwed the pooch professionally at the very least, I seethed. Two wrongs don't make a right. In my mind, they raise the number of wrongs to another power. Keep raising the number of sins of omission and commission until you can't see the forest for the trees, or the cliches. A few days passed without incident. I got back into the regular routine of picking up rolls of film, processing them, and delivering the finished pictures. Wayne and his wife were still not certain if the business was right for them. That was fine with me. Now that it looked as if the S4 work was truly over, I needed some income. Having the familiar rhythms of work also soothed my admittedly raw nerves. The work also gave me an excuse to get out of the house, both to be away from Tracy and to allow me to meet face-to-face with Jean, John, and Jason, each separately. I told them about the meeting I'd had with Dennis. Our conversations were brief. We commiserated for a while. I told them that I had things under control. It was worrisome, of course, but I thought that having gone out there with each of them had provided me with a kind of insurance policy. Gratefully, they were each okay with that, and didn't feel I'd betrayed them or put them in jeopardy. John's opinion held a little more weight with me because of the kind of work he sometimes did for the government and the people he knew in the CIA. He suggested that I get the hell out of there right away. He'd asked if the surveillance teams were back, and I told him that they were. You can hunker down here in the bunker if you need to. In fact, you should. He unlocked one of the gun cabinets in his study to show me a part of his collection, unnecessary since I already knew about them. They'd be fools to try to come storming in here. A, it would be really hard for them to get in here, and B, it would be too high profile of a scene. That's not how they like to operate. I thanked him and told him I'd consider it, and in fact I did stay there for a few nights over the next couple of weeks. With me barely noticing it, we turned the page on April and moved into May. I still had in mind the fact that Dennis was going to call me, and he'd instructed me to be around for that. At that stage, I didn't want to piss him off any more than I already had. By the start of the second week of May, nearly a month after the meeting with Dennis, I was driving back from a photo drop-off at Jean's office. I was on the east side of Las Vegas on Eastern Avenue, heading for home via Charleston Boulevard and then the freeway. A half mile or so from the on-ramp, I noticed a car coming up from behind, closing somewhat quickly. I was driving the sports car that I'd taken out to Indian Springs, the 280Z. Maybe it was a remnant of my jet car days and being around people at drag strips, but my first assumption, confirmed when the car didn't overtake me but pulled alongside, was that this was someone looking for a race or otherwise messing around. Instinct took over, and I accelerated, thinking I'd beat them to the on-ramp. I cut in front of them, and they pulled alongside again. A quick sidelong glance allowed me to see two head shapes, nothing more distinct than that, in the car's front seat. We did this catch-up, speed-up thing one more time before we got to the on-ramp. I had to slow at that point in order to make the turn. I was ahead of them and figured that was that. It wasn't. The on-ramp was a single lane, and the other car drove with two wheels on the shoulder and two in the dirt and grass alongside it. Adrenaline shot through me, as much because I wondered if I was going to witness a crash, and also from fear of who these guys were and what they might try to do to me. A shot rang out, and I felt the rear of my car slewing sideways. Instinctively, I turned the wheel hard left to correct, and that took me off the ramp and into the grass. I came to a stop. I was paralyzed with fear at that moment. I sat with my arms, elbows locked, head pointed straight ahead, just waiting, certain that someone was going to come up to the window and fire another shot at me. I don't know how long I sat in that position, but by the time I looked around, all the dust had settled, the other car was nowhere in sight. I eased the driver's side door open and got out. Traffic thumped by on the boulevard, and I could hear the faint whish and whoosh of interstate traffic in the distance. Keeping time with thumps was my thudding heart. I walked around the back of the car and saw that my passenger side rear tire was flat and that a round hole was visible in the sidewall. I probed the opening with my finger, felt the strands of rubber, and above that, nearer the tread, the steel belts. I determined that the tire still had enough structural integrity to support the car. I was no more than 5 miles or so from home. All I wanted to do was get out of there and get to a safe place. By this time, the sun had gone down completely, and it was full-on dark, so I put on my emergency flashers. I made it onto the expressway, and doing no more than 20 to 30 miles an hour in the right lane, made for home. I was grateful that a utility company truck pulled in behind me. The driver must have noticed the tire and my distress. He put on the flashing lights on the roof of his vehicle, as well as his hazard lights. All of that flashing drew a lot of attention, and reminded me a bit of the scene in the desert, but I was glad for the escort to my exit. As I drove along, the reality of what had happened started to set in. I'd fired weapons often enough to know that it's hard to hit a target from a standstill. To be able to fire from a moving car into another moving car and hit a tire was either a stroke of luck, good luck for me that they hadn't hit the gas tank or me, and bad luck for them if either of those two options had been their intent, and bad luck for me if these guys had been aiming for that target and had succeeded in hitting it. Those guys would have had to be pros. Maybe all they wanted to do was warn me. If so, the message was received. I got another bit of fright when I pulled off the expressway. The utility truck followed me off the ramp and all the way home. I briefly considered not going home and trying to lose them. I told myself to just calm down and proceed to James Lovell. When I signaled to enter my driveway, the truck flashed its bright lights in recognition and went on its way. I breathed another sigh of relief and gratitude. I slumped at the wheel for a few seconds, my forehead resting on it. When I looked up, I noticed that there was another car, one unfamiliar to me, parked alongside me. Startled, I wondered if it was best to just remain inside or try to run for it. A few seconds later, a woman in a dark suit tight-walked over to me, waving an envelope in her hand. What was this? A processes server notifying me that I was being sued for divorce? A female assassin? Publisher's clearinghouse coming to inform me that I was a lucky winner? It turned out to be none of those. As she got closer, I recognized her as Joyce, another real estate appraiser. I was supposed to have stopped by her office after Jean's. In all the commotion, I'd completely forgotten. I got out of the car and stepped into a cloud of perfume.
"Bob, I hope you don't mind. I live nearby, and I was on my way to dinner. A date, actually. Nice place off the strip. First time going there."
So excited. "It's okay, Joyce. I owe you an apology."
"It's fine, Bob. Just fine. Just that I'll need these tomorrow. You know how it is, Bob."
I'd begun to wonder if she was going to bob me to death. "Sure, I do." I went to lean against the car, casually, but feeling a bit lightheaded after the rush. I staggered a little, given the car's leaning lopsidedness. She looked at me, then down at her feet, and then at me again, appraising.
"Bob, your car looks a little funny. Or is your driveway sagging?"
"I'd get that taken care of. Professional opinion, of course, Bob." "No, driveway's fine. Just that someone shot my tire out a little earlier."
"Oh, well, only in Vegas."
She handed the envelope with the film roll in it. "I really, really need these first thing in the morning, Bob." I nodded.
"Enjoy your evening, Joyce," I said, realizing that I was seriously outgunned in the name game.
As she drove away, I marveled at how she had acted, as if someone getting the tire of a car shot out while driving was just a normal part of the daily commute. But it wasn't. I was completely unnerved. After the brief mini-absurdity with Joyce, I returned to the other absurdity in my life. Despite Joyce's assessment that these kinds of things happen in Vegas, they didn't. I could have encountered some random act of violence, but in my gut, I sensed something more sinister lurking beneath the surface of a coincidence gone bad. Dennis had said they would be in touch. Was this the form that re-establishing of communication was going to take? Given the circumstances, I abandoned my no phone calls rule. I immediately got in touch with Jean and John. John was emphatic. I had to get over to his place immediately. It was the safest location for me, and thought that together we could formulate a plan of action. I decided it was best to do as John instructed. Jean had been in favor all along of me getting away from the house and potentially out of Las Vegas. In the weeks since I'd met with Dennis, the observers had been a constant presence, though they had stopped tailing me. By the time I'd arrived, it seemed as if John had already formulated the start of a plan.
"You protected yourself by telling us about what you were doing, right?"
"Yes."
"And that worked, didn't it?"
"Well, John, I don't know about worked."
"You're still above ground, aren't you? Still breathing."
"That's true."
"So what I think is, stick with the formula. Except you tweak it a little bit. Go wider with the information."
"How do I do that? Stand on a street corner like some loon with a days until doomsday sign?"
"That would work. But your sign painting skills probably aren't up to snuff. I've seen your handwriting."
"I think you're right about going wider. I was thinking of that myself."
"Mind if I call George Knapp? Get him over here? I trust him."
"Fine." George Knapp was a reporter for the local ABC affiliate in Las Vegas. He covered the usual stuff, but also did some investigative journalism into political corruption and the like. He was also one of the first journalists in the city to really poke around and into Area 51. He'd interviewed John before, and if John liked him and trusted him, even considering John's lack of a filter, that was good enough for me. John got me a drink and escorted me into his office. I was joined later by George and his boss, the station's manager, Bob Stovall. It seemed a bit strange to be face-to-face with a man who was in my living room a lot of nights. George had a straightforward demeanor and a candor that put me at ease. John, on the other hand, didn't. He was looking out for my best interests, but he immediately took the lead in speaking with the two TV guys. He was acting as if he was my attorney, not as if he was asking for a favor, essentially. He started out by making demands, telling them I'd go on camera, wouldn't reveal my name, and I would only answer yes or no questions. That last bit got to me.
It's not like I'm on trial, John. You don't have to worry about me saying too much and possibly incriminating myself.
I can't believe now how naive I was to believe that I wasn't going to be put on trial. Not in the legal sense, but in the court of public opinion. I shared more of my story with George and Bob, and eventually we came to an agreement. We'd do a piece that they would broadcast the following day. I wouldn't use my own name, they would only show me in silhouette to protect my identity, and I would give them responses that went beyond simple yes or no replies. I was concerned about the guys watching my house, so they left it up to me to give them the location, and they would send a truck over. I'd think about it overnight and see who would be willing to have this all go on. We chatted for a while longer, then shook hands. John and I sat up long into the night, speculating about how my coming forward on television would be received by Dennis and the powers that be. We knew I would be stirring up a shitstorm in the desert, but kicking the sand up in someone's face was better than having my tires shot out from underneath me. Maybe it was the product of such a long day, but it took me a while to realize that a shitstorm and a sandstorm weren't quite the same thing. But John must have understood, except for one thing. He dozed off. I made my way to the guest bedroom and figured that a shower would help ease some of the tension from my body. I stood under the spray with my eyes shut, the sound of the water on my skull a soothing and sibilant tone. I wondered if I was doing the right thing, half marveled and half bemoaned the fact that it had all come down to this. I wasn't prone to the if-onlys, but as the room filled with steam, and I could finally feel some weariness overtaking me, I wondered what it would have been like if I had been content to remain Bob the Photo Guy. And later, as I drifted off to sleep, I wondered after tomorrow who I would be known as. One thing was for certain, I wasn't going to be Bob the blank.
Chapter 9. There are times when you just have to trust your gut instinct. There are times when you have to trust other people. When the two of those are working in concert, then there's a pretty good chance that you're heading in the right direction. Though I didn't know George Knapp at all before I met him, I trusted that he believed in my story, and he believed that it needed to be made available for wider consumption. I'd gone back and forth on the issue of the public's right to know about the presence of these craft and our government and military's involvement with them. I wasn't, strictly speaking, anti-authoritarian. I didn't rebel against people in positions of power just because they were in power. What generally got me a bit riled up was when authorities injudiciously wielded power or didn't account for the fact that not everyone was incapable of behaving rationally. Again, that's going back to the idea of a widespread panic or serious social disruption resulting from revelations that there were other life forms in the universe and we'd had contact with them. I'm not sure I bought into that idea completely. I also understood that whoever was able to decrypt how this astounding technology worked needed, as the phrase goes, to use their powers for good and not evil. And if no one but a select few knew we had that power, then they would have greater reign to do with it what they wanted and without impunity. That was not good. But as I woke up in John's house and thought more and more about what I'd committed to, the on-camera interview, my decision was based more on self-preservation than altruism. The blend wasn't so highly concentrated with self-interest than it had been, but it was still predominant. I wasn't trying to be a hero. I was simply trying to still be, to continue to exist.
In the passage of time, I can recount these events in a much more reasonable, much more logical fashion. At the time, I was in a state of panic, wondering if my decision to go wide was going to fan the smoldering embers into a fire, or throw enough water on them to douse them completely. I knew that I had the full support of George, Jean, and John. That was helpful, but in the end, only one person should be responsible for decisions like these, the one whose life is most immediately going to be affected. To say that I discussed my decision with Tracy would be a gross overstatement. I informed her of what I was going to do, but I didn't ask for permission, nor did I consult with her about how I should conduct myself. To her credit, she and her sister both decided to accompany me on the set of the interview. I realize that using the word set, as in a movie set, implies some kind of fictional aspect of what was going on, but we did stage the interview at my request. I mention this only because of how the day proceeded. I had agreed to appear in silhouette, and so the camera operator who accompanied George, the sound guy, and George himself all had to figure out how to achieve the visual effects they wanted to make it look interesting and to abide by my request that my identity be protected. Because, as Jean kept reminding me, John Lear's house was a kind of secure compound, we chose to do the interview at his place. I don't care who you are or where you live or what kind of relationship you have with your neighbors, if you drive along in a remote coverage TV news van with its call letters and insignia emblazoned all over it into someone's driveway, you're going to draw a crowd of onlookers, even if the van disappears from view. Most of the time when I'd gone to visit John, I'd parked in his driveway. It wasn't possible to be seen from the street, so it was unlikely that anyone would be able to identify me when I came out of the house and got positioned to speak with George. For that reason, on May 14, 1989, my supporters and I stood around waiting while the technicians did their thing. George had briefed me very generally about the kinds of questions he was going to ask, and I had to appear on camera for a couple of test shoots to make sure that I was framed properly and the lighting worked out. I couldn't resist one more poke at those in charge of the program, and I instructed George to refer to me by my chosen pseudonym, Dennis. I'm not sure if that qualifies as gallows humor, but I did have a small sense of what it might be like to be facing a moment so heavily freighted with consequences. I chose to look at the interview as an example of one of the most widely known principles of physics, Newton's first and second laws of motion. I could still act on what I'd set into motion, and even up until the last moment, when I was standing on my mark and George stood off camera and signaled to me that it was a go, I still wasn't certain if I'd let any words come out of my mouth. I did, and I found that the release of one was easily followed by another, and then more and more. We talked for perhaps 5 minutes. I gave George the basics. The interview was more about the existence of the craft, my role at S4 generally, and involved no critique of the program, no mention of why it was or how it was that I had become embroiled in a dispute with my now former employees. When it was aired, we all gathered to watch it at John's house. The interview was pared down to just a couple of minutes at most. It hit all the high points, and I got a big kick out of seeing the name Dennis appear on screen beneath my shadowy image. I was glad that George had kept in the part about me stating that I believed the technology needed to be kept classified. The fact that we obtained the technology from an extraterrestrial civilization should be public knowledge. I'd finally settle on that as my stance, believed it at that moment, and continued to believe it ever since. I had no idea how the piece was going to be received. I felt some relief that, again to revert to the Newtonian metaphor, I'd set an object in motion. That would at least govern to some degree what they did next and what I did next. Like I said, I've always been a lover of big reactions and explosions and that sort of thing. Being inert and observing things that are inert is, for the most part, tedious. I wanted to see how all of this was going to be resolved, and I hoped that it would be so sooner rather than later. Either let me go back to my old life, or at least let me deal with the new one. After the broadcast was over, I returned to my home on James Lovell. I didn't feel like I was in exile from my shattered marriage or my possibly ruined career as a scientist. As I saw it, I'd done nothing wrong and shouldn't walk around feeling like a leper or a pariah. That feeling didn't last very long. The phone rang, and I picked up. "Bob, do you have any idea what we're going to do to you now?" "No." It was Dennis. He didn't say anything else, and in a second or two, the connection terminated. So much for any kind of certainty, so much for the laws of physics somehow applying here, so much for feeling safe and secure in my home. Without a word to Tracy, I slipped out the door and returned to John's house, where I spent the night. I lay in the dark and thought about all the ways that this should matter, but concluded as the first gray light of morning came through the windows that living or dying was seldom a question of choice. It was often governed by forces inside and outside of ourselves, but I was too tired and too distraught by all that had gone on to really care which outcome was produced. As before, I also gave some thought to fleeing, but knowing who I was dealing with and powers they likely possessed, running away seemed fruitless.